Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 140, featuring an amazing person, Johnny Gibson from Pixamundo. And Johnny has had a very, very interesting and colorful past, and is a really, really, really bright guy who I have admired for a very long time. And I've had a great conversation with him and learned a whole lot about his history. Really fascinating stuff. And it's just awesome that Johnny was able to stop by. We actually tried to do this podcast several times, and every time there was some major thing that happened. So we talk a little bit about that. But anyway, really love Johnny. Okay, so some announcements to make. First big thing is, let's talk about some V-Ray announcements. V-Ray 3.6 is now available for Maya. So if you guys are using V-Ray for Maya, 3.6 just dropped. You can go ahead and download. That's a free download for anyone that's using version 3 or higher. And there's a lot of new features in there that are pretty cool. The new hybrid rendering is in there. Crypto mats is in there and several other great features. So go ahead and check it out and go to chaosgroup.com to find out more about the 3.6 features as well as being able to download it there. Also, if you guys happen to be interested in VR scans, I know some people have tried it, but we're now extending the trial period. So if you want to, because people seem to need more time trying things out. So go ahead and it's now the trial has gone from a 30-day trial to a 90-day trial. So if you are interested in checking out VR scans, you now have a 90-day trial, which is pretty cool. Other big announcements is that as of this podcast coming out, I am actually going to be in Portugal for Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn, which I'm very excited about. As you know, I love to go to this conference, and I usually come back with a whole bunch of really interesting podcasts once I'm there. And I am actually going to be a speaker there this year. Yay! So if you are at THU, you can go ahead and listen to my talk. It's going to be very exciting. It's going to be about the WikiHuman Project, believe it or not. So very excited to have that talk. And I'm also going to be doing something really interesting, and it's going to be part of THU TV. I don't think all the details have been figured out just yet, but we'll have some really great, basically I'm going to be giving a whole series of talks or hosting a whole series of talks that are going to be broadcast live on THU TV. So that's going to be great. And there's two other guys that are doing it as well. So it's going to be three hosts that are going to be going all day and chatting on THU TV. Really should be really a lot of fun to watch. And I think that's about all the THU news that I have for now. So that being said, hopefully you will enjoy this awesome podcast with the amazing, the incredible, the brilliant Johnny Gibson.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Last time we tried to do this, I unfortunately had a horrible accident that happened.
Yeah, I think that so far we've been cursed, but I'm finally here.
You're finally here.
It was what? We had to deliver, then I got sick, I went to China, and then, so we've tried this a few times, and then the motorcycle accident then, way here.
On the way here, you had a motorcycle accident, that felt horrible, but you're fine. I think you said you're getting rid of the bike? You were considering it?
It's one of those things where, you know, after each accident, you kind of weigh the odds of things happening again. And
the pros and cons.
Yeah, you know, there's death involved, whatever. Yeah. I haven't decided yet. I still like commuting on it. Parking's a bear in Santa Monica, so.
Yeah.
You know, as long as we're in LA, I think I'll probably have a bike.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's a thing now, unfortunately, with accidents. But you know, the first time that I remember you was,
oh, so we're in the interview now.
Oh yeah,
we're just having a fun conversation. Yay!
First time I remember seeing you was, God, I want to say.
Was it Stealth?
Nope. 1997.
Holy crap.
And you were giving a presentation with Doug Robel.
Yeah, I remember that.
At SIGGRAPH.
Production
stuff. So there was the conversation was about short-term development versus long-term development.
Right.
He was Mr. Long-term Development because he would make long-term tools that would last for many shows. And you were like, I need a solution for this thing, for this specific shot or something.
Tomorrow.
Yeah. Right. And it was...
Which in those days wasn't ever tomorrow. It was next week, but have a version tonight.
Right. Right. And you were specifically talking about Grinch, I think, show. So that's about the right time, right?
Yeah, I was talking about shaders, I think. We had to do a lot of procedural stuff.
For the snow.
Yeah, not just for the snow, but for all of the environments and terrain.
Right.
You remember, it was, if you couldn't paint everything, which we couldn't, a lot of fractals were involved. We couldn't fit a lot into memory at the time. We were using RenderMem back in the SIMD days, the exclusive SIMD days.
Yeah.
And... I think at the time, I was just talking about trying to zero in on a solution very quickly, and how that feedback worked, and how shaders came into play for that. Because I use shaders as a good median for where everything happens in CG, right? Yeah, because it kind of is, right? Like the shader takes over, especially back in those days in the SIMD architectures. The shader takes over and it's right in the middle of the pipeline.
Right.
You could say compositing was, but it wasn't really, that's where the finishing happened. But, animation, modeling, everything, that all culminates in that shader, and the shader takes control.
Right. It was kind of an interesting thing. Just, it introduced me to the idea of a TD and what a TD is and what the roles and responsibilities and the challenges involved in being a TD.
Yeah, that's the
one. Because I wasn't even in the industry back then. I was still in architecture, and I sort of it was just a curious concept from an outsider of what a technical director actually does.
Well, I think it's one of those historical terms, and that comes from the stage plays, where the guy who's directing the lighting for the show is technical, so he's the technical director for...
Well, that's where it comes from?
I think so.
Okay.
I'm not absolutely positive, but it's one of those things I've heard thrown around in that community.
Because it's confusing when you say, if I say, oh, he's a technical director, you assume that that's the person in charge of all technology.
Yes. Yeah, and it's totally the opposite of that.
It's the opposite of that.
Most places, it's just the lighter now.
Yes. Well, no. I don't think people use the TD term as lighter anymore.
Oh, well, most of the companies that I've been to.
Really?
That's been the term that, do we need to light the chart? Get me two TDs. That's one of those things.
TD, I always thought of them as the people that are problem solving, right?
Yeah, that's how I think of it, too.
Or creating tools, so short-term tools. The thing that's different is back then, let's say back 20 years ago, whatever, a lighter was that person, right?
Yeah,
because obviously a lighter had to write all the tools to do it.
How was he supposed to do a shot?
Right. The only way is to write the tools to do it.
Yeah, back then we were writing our own render scripts, our own render submission scripts. We were trading them like playing cards.
Right.
Yeah, our trading cards.
Right.
And it blossomed out from that, I think. And I remember when we spun up the TD department at DD.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was one of the first ones. And it was still a free-for-all then because, we were doing everything from deciding how the pipeline design was supposed to work all the way through to writing shaders and lighting shots and doing effects. There are effects TDs,
We
still have that term.
Yes. No, they are. Yes, you're right. So was DD your first job in visual effects? What got you to the...
Let's see. It's a little bit soft. I had a career before I went into entertainment at all.
A lot of us did.
I was in... a secret research project at TRW for ballistic missiles for early detection and warning and tracking. Using hyperspectral scans of entire theaters of combat.
Okay. How did you get into that?
I was
a couple steps back from that one.
Well, when I was in grad school in computer science, I liked to build things.
Uh-huh.
I like to sculpt and whatever
else. Yeah, yeah.
And so I fell into this role of teaching the hardware classes. So we would build computers out of IC chips, that sort of thing.
Right.
And then people would end up with giant breadboards, maybe two or three breadboards that are, have like big spaghetti wires going in between them because they have to have eight lines of data bus and
right.
eight lines of address bus. And so when I was teaching one of those courses, teaching the lab section for one of those courses, I had a couple of students who came through and they showed a lot of insight. And so they started talking to me about my interest in, you know, where I was expecting to go. And I showed a lot of interest in image processing and which is where I ended up focusing for my, my master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And, so they said, well, they started talking to me about some of their problems, but sort of veiled in secrecy. Right. And,
okay.
And so we had a few conversations and they said, you need to apply as soon as you graduate. And so behind the scenes, I think what happened was somebody got in touch with my advisor
mm-hmm.
and my research and study went into hyperspectral stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up working on this project. I think it's declassified now. I'm not going to go too much into it.
But sure.
It's, it was like training neural networks to spot missiles that were launching. And the trick, this is back in the, you know, I'm sorry to date myself. Right. I'm almost 50. so when I was in grad school, we were at the tail end of what would have been considered the Cold War.
Right.
And one of the strategies for like a first launch, mm-hmm. like a preemptive attack would be if you launched a bunch of dummy missiles
mm-hmm.
to trick the early warning systems into zooming in. And so the optics are working against you in that case, because to identify a missile launch, whether or not it's dummy or it's a threat
mm-hmm.
or if it's a test, you had to zoom in on the missile.
Right.
And when you do that, then you abandon the rest of your theater. You can't see anything else. Right.
Okay.
So what we were working on was to never zoom. How do we identify like a payload and what the missile was and, you know, what the launch characteristics were without zooming in? And so we ended up with a system that could scan like 127 kilometers per
okay.
pixel, but with 90 bands worth of spectral information.
Okay.
So we see in three bands, right? Red, green,
RGB.
And blue.
Yeah.
Exactly. So our visual systems are what we call tri-band.
Okay.
These systems saw 90 bands, and from the deep infrared into the deep ultraviolet.
Mm-hmm.
And so based on those spectral profiles,
mm-hmm.
You could plot different characteristics that a neural net could spot and identify. So we could do things like understand how much payload a missile was lifting, how many warheads it might be carrying, what the engine characteristics were, what the fuel was, et cetera.
This is going to become important again.
I'm hoping that the fucker is up there.
Yeah.
Because I feel safer.
Mm-hmm.
But that's essentially what my like precure was. The gotcha is when we started working on the simulator for it. And just to illustrate to the military, and I did a lot of travel to DC to do the like pitches and back up the technology and things like that. So I talked to the Department of Energy, the Department of Defense.
Right.
My last trip there, I talked to the Department of Forestry because we put one of these on a helicopter and scanned some forests for sit like sick trees.
Okay.
And so our pitch was you could very quickly spot an outbreak of a disease in a forest.
Interesting.
And I think they sold that, but I left before that because okay. I was stressing over this simulation we were running where we would model like launch characteristics for a first strike. And I kept, you know, our team, I don't want to take exclusive mm-hmm. responsibility for this because of course it was a small team,
mm-hmm.
but the team was continue to be disappointed because we'd lose 6 million people in New York or we,
right.
you know, or lose a major city or whatever else because our system made mistakes.
System. Right. Yeah.
And I couldn't stand the mistakes because the reality was that I started to internalize that it was real. You know, mm-hmm. this is something that at some point might have to be deployed. And if it failed, a lot of people could die. It could be our fault.
Right.
So I started to have all these stress and panic attacks.
War games, basically, what you're talking about.
It's war games, but for real. You know.
No, I know.
A lot of strange stories with that, like where the FBI would call my parents just for clearance, but they wouldn't tell them what it was for, so my parents would freak out. And they put me in the hallway for the first, I think, 6 months, 3 to 6 months, something like that, because I wasn't cleared. And so I actually was disconnected from the network and had a desk out like in this reception area.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't allowed in the secure area. And they had a guy whose exclusive job was to falsify data so that we could run it on the algorithms. Hmm. You know, that sort of thing.
Interesting.
But I had to get out of that. And I knew, I mean, since I was 8 years old, I was a huge visual effects fan, like specifically visual effects. Like,
why was that?
I don't know. There was I've always been a sketch artist.
Uh-huh.
I've always loved aesthetics. I should have been an architect. I don't know why I didn't go into that. You know, the idea of automation and building machines and building cameras and control systems for that sort of thing, just for entertainment accuracy, mm-hmm. was really appealing to me. So I sort of had like this 50-50 balance, even as a child, where I loved mechanics and engineering and I loved visuals. Mm-hmm. And so even as an 8-year-old, I was, you know, reading about Willis O'Brien and, you know, Kong 1933 and my first hero was John Dykstra, you know, like all the other kids are growing up and they're, you know, saying, oh, my dad's my hero. I'm like, oh, John Dykstra is my hero.
Right.
As an 8-year-old. You know, and how many people can say that they're on a first name basis with their first hero?
Yeah, it's true.
Other than like people who, you know, their dad.
Right.
You know, so I feel very fortunate in that. But
I was just not long ago, I actually did a podcast with him, with Tom Main, who's like one of my favorite living architects. I happened to do a podcast with him, so it was a little overwhelming, honestly speaking. And like,
Well, but he's cool, right? Like, yeah. He'll talk to anybody. He knows he's just a normal person. And
John Dykstra is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a really cool guy.
I visited ILM a while back just to visit friends. No, I wasn't interviewing mm-hmm. anybody who's listening out there. and I ran across one of the Dykstra Flex control boxes.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just like, oh, that's just, this is the one thing I have to photograph here. You know?
Right. Yeah, well, so you, psychologically speaking, obviously you had a little bit of an issue dealing with what you were building, even though, you know, it was as good, you just have a harder time. So you just said, I need to get out of this.
And yeah, well, it wasn't so much I needed to get out of it. It was that I knew that there was an emotional response to it that didn't lend itself well to that.
Okay.
And then, of course, at the same time, this is sort of the end of the Cold War and things are ramping down. They were closing Air Force bases. Mm-hmm. And I kind of knew that's the direction it was going. And so even though I probably could have easily kept a career in defense, mm-hmm. I knew that my real passion was someplace else because there was no component of creativity other than just coding it. And I knew I wanted to be in the arts, and I knew that I could leverage my technical skill doing it. You know, I had the master's degree at the time, I had the bachelor's degree, and I kind of had a lot of tools underneath me, but I really needed to stretch those creative wings. And so right about the time, and this is a pretty interesting turn of events, my buddy calls me from my college, and he says, well, we've got this experiment running with Marvel Films. Okay. And it's for Saturday morning TV programming, and we need someone that really can understand CG. And I'd written on my own like rudimentary ray tracer and things like that when I was in college, and so that my name came up, and mm-hmm. so they called me and said, "Do you want to try doing the CG stuff?" And so we started doing like the opening sequence to things like I think it was called the Marvel Action Hour mm-hmm. with Iron Man and the Fantastic Four. I think mm-hmm. that's the whole title. I'm not sure. And so I did some of the CG setup and things for that. And, you know, back in those days, it was like really, really crude. There were no IKEA controls. It was just like rotating joints to get it to animate. And we had no feedback.
Right.
So we were doing our best. From that, and this is really an important, poignant part for my job now, is during that effort, there was a lot of rotoscoping, like effect style rotoscoping. So like lasers and smoke trails and explosions and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so you're basically tracing, you know, that stuff on a per frame basis, and you become very sensitive to the timing of how that stuff behaves.
Right.
And so now when I'm looking at an effects element and something's bothering me about it, it's really easy to sit down and really analyze it and just go, the attack is too short, or the attack is too long and it's too smooth, mm-hmm. and it's not jittery enough here, and this frequency doesn't exist, mm-hmm. and we're missing frequencies here and here. You know, it's really easy to look at things like that because I had that experience.
Interesting.
You know, and I consider that now really invaluable. Back then, it was really hard for me to accept because to me, it was just tracing.
Right.
You know?
I remember actually when you and I were on Stealth, Ryan Vance was...
Vance Can Dance.
Yeah. He was trying to write his own ray tracer, and, you know, while he was waiting for TD tasks, he was trying to write it, and you were helping him with that process?
Oh, I wouldn't say anything I did ever helped anybody, but
right. I remember him, like, he had a lot of questions because he was like, yeah, I want to try this out. And you had written one, so you had known some of the
Wrote was way more crude than what he was working on. Because keep in mind that he was working off the Matt Farr book, I think.
Probably, yeah.
And so he probably had, you know, really nice code to work from and examples to work from. And really, the questions he was asking was like, how would you want this to work? Like, right. As an artist, how would you want to work and how would you code that?
Well, it was interesting because I got to witness firsthand all the different steps that were taken, right? So he kind of wrote the fundamental part of the ray tracing and then was handling the geometry and then trying different acceleration structures like gray structure, BSP trees, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of rediscovering like how people had to work with ray tracers and PBR renderers back in those days.
Yeah, it was very interesting to sort of go through that steps and see him.
It was like an accelerated course in rendering, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, because he was really interested in it and he was experiencing the same things that everyone who writes a tracer has to go through. Mostly, you know, like sorting. Like that's the most boring part is the most important part, right?
Right. It's the faster you can sort through the data, then the better it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was fascinating to think about. And of course, the thing he was also saying is like, yeah, polygons are annoying, like if you could just make everything because polygons require you to make the tree, like if you just define everything as a shape, whatever that arbitrary shape is,
and then you have to check for connectivity just so you don't have holes in the rendering and, that gets in the way.
It was really interesting. So so that was a little bit fast forward side story, but so my first thing was like, you know, like I said, you talking about the Grinch, and then I went back to I went to DD for the first time on Day After Tomorrow. You were not at DD at that time.
Left. I had gone for the opportunity to high-level supervise. So I took a CG supervisor position at Tippett Studio on one of the Matrix movies. But the thing is, you know, we think of CG supervisors now as someone who solves problems and sets up shots for people. Back then at the different facilities, it was more like you were kind of like the right hand of, in this case, I was the right hand of the visual effects supervisor.
Right.
So there was no digital supervisor. I kind of filled both those roles.
Gotcha.
And that was a super valuable experience too, because I learned a lot from him because he was a really solid leader at the time. I don't know, before that I've heard other stories, but when I was working with him, he was just really knew how to get people to shine.
This is Phil Tippett.
No, this is Craig Hayes.
Craig Hayes, okay.
I have a deep admiration for Craig Hayes.
Okay.
So I actually never worked directly with Phil. I advised in a few of his projects, but I didn't have time because we were working on a Matrix movie.
Okay.
But I can't say how much working at Tippett in that role was valuable to me, because keep in mind, I'd spent a large span of time, and I forgot, like I started in what, 1996, 97, something like that.
At DD.
Yeah, like Fifth Element. I think I was originally hired to come on for Donnie's Peak, but I came on ended up working on Fifth Element and Titanic right out of the gate and then stayed on Titanic until the end. And then, so I was there from 96, and then I think I left to go to Tippett in 2002 or something like that.
Okay.
So I'd been at DD for like a large section of what my professional career would have been at the time.
Right.
And so DD at the time was mostly compositing and effects.
Okay.
There was very little character work that other than commercials where it was just like one-off kinds of things. And certainly no like photo humans or anything like that. Digital doubles weren't a thing. But I got to Tippett and it was all characters. You know, the whole pipeline was like very character centric and very character asset centric. And I got to see it from the other perspective. And so that by itself is totally invaluable, because I brought something to the table that you know, my effects experience, my shading experience, they happened to be using RenderMan as well. And may still, I'm not sure. You know, I met so many people that had different perspectives than me that I ended up like completely respecting. Mm-hmm. And because I had that different set of experiences and had some expertise, I think there was a mutual respect that just blossomed, especially on that show. And we did a lot of great work on that show because of it, I think.
Right.
Where Davey Wentworth was a render watcher at the beginning of the show. Then I started showing like some render men things at lunch, mm-hmm. and he kept coming to those. And so when we had to splinter off a team to get a new sequence that we had to wrap up for another facility, that I didn't think we could do initially until we actually sat down and broke it down.
Right.
It was something like 60 shots in like 4 weeks. You know, and at the time that's pretty impactful.
Yeah.
So we splintered off like a 4 or 5 person team, and I wrote the shaders to shade like the tunnels, the below ground tunnels, procedurally.
Oh, interesting.
Those were all shaded procedurally, and then some of the color was splashed on to guide the procedurals. And mm-hmm. I mean, it was doing stuff. I had to put a lot of thought into this, but it was doing stuff like procedurally generating panels and panel lines, and procedurally generating bolts and bolt structures, and, right. and rust coming off the bolts and ladders and just stuff
right.
in the tunnels. And so we covered that whole thing, and it was just basically the modeler just, you know, would model and lay it out. And then we flew the path with the hammer. It was originally called
right.
Mjolnir, which is actually pronounced Mjolnir.
We should probably let people know, because I know, you know, I know this, but some people may not realize that back in those days, writing a shader was literally writing a shader.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you would code a shader. It wasn't like you had this nice GUI and you connected a bunch of things. And
no,
like,
in fact, I still don't use that in most things, because I love self-similarity and fractals and things right. like that. And those are much harder to construct
right.
in a neural network.
So you literally write the shader still yourself.
I'm VFXing now, so it's really hard to get that kind of time. But when I sit down and I want to, and I do it, then yeah, I still write, in the source code language,
right.
whatever it may be.
Right. That's interesting, because a lot of people don't feel a need for that. I mean, that was one of the things that sort of happened later, is that when I was starting at DD, like everyone wrote every shader by hand for everything. And there was a new shader for every show practically.
Right. And what's worse than that is now we have to think in terms of PBR. So the shader is just advising the renderer
right.
what the color is, but the renderer is controlling the distribution of light,
right.
the bounce and where the light goes and how it sorts it.
Right.
And that's just a necessity, right?
Right.
You can't really effectively do that in a shader. But back then you had an output color. So you were painting by numbers. You
right.
were in control of everything.
Right. That's it.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. It's really interesting to think about how that affects everything. And I remember when I went to Sony, like they basically just had a giant Uber shader that would do everything. And that was...
Yeah, a lot of people had that. Definitely Tippett had that. DD evolved that over time, although they were a little late coming to the game. I think
yeah.
they were looking at some of the other people's work and seeing how that helped production-wise.
Mm-hmm.
I have a differing opinion, because I tend to think of it in terms of efficiency and like compile times and things like that. And if you have a huge Uber shader,
mm-hmm.
you know, you might spend 5 minutes instantiating before you even start rendering.
Right,
you know,
right.
And so it really depends. Like if you need to pipeline everything, it makes total sense.
Yeah.
You know, because the machine's going to sit and spin on it for a couple of minutes. Sure, whatever.
Right.
You know, and if you have one, then it only has to happen once.
Yeah, I don't know. At this point, I'm just pretty happy with a standard physically based shading system.
Oh yeah, me too.
I don't have to write all that stuff
anymore. Yeah, at the supervisory level, I lift my hands to that, because at some point, you got to let go and let people do their jobs the way they know they can work.
Sure.
Even if it's going to take extra CPU cycles.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's, and you know, at this point, computers are, I mean, back then, computers were slower than your iPhone, right? So
yeah,
or whatever phone you have. I happen to have a Nexus. That's all right. So you were at Tippett, and then you came back, because I remember you coming back to DD on Stealth.
On Stealth, yeah.
Right.
That was a funny story too. I used to bike every day at lunch at Tippett, because there's lots of bikes pass up there.
Sure.
It's really nice.
Yeah.
And I was biking one day at lunch, and I'm biking by one of these mall areas, just through on the bike path,
mm-hmm.
and I see Darren Grant walking in front of me. I'm like, I stop my bike and do a double take, and I'm like, am I dreaming? What is this?
Right.
And it really was him. And they were there recruiting. I think that there was a layoff in one of the local facilities, maybe Pixar.
Right.
And so they'd come up to recruit. And so him and Jeff.
This was not uncommon, by the way. Back in those days when the studio would start to ramp down people because they lost a show or they don't have a next show lined up, and people, like other studios would just descend like vultures.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's constructive too, right?
Because it is constructive because everyone gets work at that point. So.
There's not a lot of break. And also, something about that, when someone's pursued that way, it gives them another chance to kind of recover from a blow.
Sure.
And yeah, I admire them for doing that too. But the funny part of the circumstance was I didn't plan to be there. I didn't know they were there, you know? And so we spent the rest of the lunch kind of hanging out and talking. And of course, at some point it came in the conversation, are you almost done?
Right.
And I'm like, I think we got about 3-4 weeks left in the schedule. So he goes, call this person. And that's how I ended up coming back.
Interesting. Yeah. And you came back for Stealth. And I think when you came in, did you take over some of the shading stuff? What was your main responsibility?
Because
everyone was like, when I remember, it was like, Johnny Gibson's back, Johnny Gibson's back. Everyone was excited about it. I remember Estrus being especially excited about it.
Well, it's nice to know that, you know, to feel that that community appreciation is something I miss in the visual effects. But I knew that was ephemeral even then.
Right.
I think because I was, well, I think at least marginally successful at souping at a very high level, going from being a TD to being a high level supervisor is a little bit of a jump. And, you know, I had my doubts going in. For some reason, Craig didn't. He just said, you're the guy, let's do it. You know what I mean? And that was a nice vote of confidence. And one of the reasons why I admire his judgment, because I doubted myself more than he doubted me. But I came out of it, you know, looking pretty good. And so when I came back, the conversation was more like, what do you want to supervise? How do you want to approach this? Do you want to work on Stealth?
Right.
It's what we're recommending. It's the big show that's coming in. They said, there's this new group ramping up for Terrain that's based in Terrigen. Brad Herman was working on it at the time. And I'm not sure of the politics, but they basically said, we need someone who's got the experience to make sure this works.
Right.
And I didn't want to step on anybody's toes. And so that's when Brad and I became friends because we just worked together and made it happen. And like halfway through that process, you know, we were working with Matt.
Matt Fairclough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To get it production ready, you know, for the show. And if I recall correctly, Matt was leaving at the time. So he was.
Well, he was going to start his own version, right?
Yeah. So they were branching the versions because we had the two interns who became like effects supervisors of someplace.
Right.
But we had Magnus and Morton.
Morton.
Yeah.
And Magnus is now a big guy over at Pixar.
Yeah. You know, everyone's turned into awesome.
Yeah.
But at the time they were filling out the code and they knew they were going to inherit the DD branch of the Terrigen code.
Right.
And
just so people know, Terrigen is a terrain or landscape creator and renderer.
Yeah. And it's the full package.
It's the full, yeah.
And I have a deep admiration for Matt and his innovations because he thought about rendering completely differently than everyone else.
Absolutely.
And what he did has not only made a package that works really well for what it does, but also if you really know how it works and understand it, you can make every other package shine using those techniques.
Yeah, it was a very unique way of looking at things. Although I got to tell you, I was a little bit frustrated for how long it stayed single-threaded.
Yeah. Well, that's fixed now. Don't worry
about it. It's fixed now, yeah. But it was like, oh my gosh, people have a lot of cores, Matt. We need more.
It's just sitting there. It's just sitting there reading.
Yes. But anyway, it was – yeah, Terrigen was really, really interesting. And I remember it being a huge part of Stealth because most of those terrains were all – digitally created.
I still refer to it to my teams. I'm working on a show now that has a lot of terrains in it, and we're using other software. But the lessons that I learned then still apply.
Sure.
You know, how to anti-alias edge on.
Right.
That's that. You could write a whole book about that. And Matt solved it by ignoring it. What? What? How did he do that?
Yeah.
It's just how he organized the models and how it rendered and how it tessellated is genius.
Interesting.
You know, and it basically ignores that problem because it doesn't need to address it. It's cool.
That's a good way to do it. Yeah. It's interesting. I even remember Rob Cohen used to call
Turgeon.
Turgeon. He used to call it Turgeon. But he also kept, just to tease Brad, he used to call him Hermione all the time.
I don't remember that. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, he was funny. He was like, where's Hermione? We got to talk about this Turgeon.
Well, I think one of the things is I had a reputation as a problem solver, if you recall.
Yeah.
And we got halfway through that development and I got pulled because the jet shading was falling behind.
Oh, yeah. God, yes.
And so we pulled a whole team into just a separate room and we just focused on the planes.
The skunkworks stuff.
Yeah, the skunkworks stuff. Yeah. And that I consider that a marginal success because it got us to the point where we could convince Rob that it was going to work. And then we branched another version of how to shade the plane.
The first version of the shader of the plane had 250 variables in it. It was a little out of control, I think. And then
I'm proud of that.
But no, it got much simpler. It got much simpler. Yeah. And it was really good. It worked just fine. There's no big issues. Landing a plane is actually tougher than it seems because it's like landing a sheet of paper sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know? Well, and then you have to deal with like the one-off weird circumstances that all planes have, like what do you do with cockpits and what do you see behind them?
Right.
You know, and how do you get those fine scratches and details in the paint?
They call them sun dogs.
I called them sun dogs probably incorrectly, but that's the name that stuck.
Okay. Because I was trying to think. I always thought of them as sun dogs probably because of you.
It's probably my fault, yeah.
And then I couldn't find anything that actually refers to them as sun dogs. But that's the micro scratches.
Yeah. How many – I didn't want to go through my days going – the micro scratches that appear radial when the specular hits it a certain way. No, that wasn't a name that we could use for that.
Right,
So we call them sun dogs.
Yeah, every time we had a shot that involved someone in the, you know, the buck, then they would put a canopy on top of
it.
And we'd have to
do that. And a visor. Don't forget the visor.
And the visors. And we had to render those out and it became, they gave all that task to the lighters and it was like, and really there was nothing to do except open the file and render.
Well, check the file to make sure that the animation is in the right place.
And then render.
Yeah, and then hope that you were going to get rounding errors in RenderMan.
Right.
Yeah.
So we got frustrated with it, and Hanzi, I think, turned it into a button.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
So you turned it into
It was a button that – I don't think you had to open up the package, right? Just like ran it.
You just ran it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so – they said, huh. So they gave it went directly from tracking to compositing.
Yeah.
And bypass lighting.
I forgot about that. You're totally right.
So does it track? Yes. Then send it to compositing.
Yeah.
So compositing, they'd basically submit their track and it would actually render the elements that were necessary and compositing would actually composite it.
Yeah. That was great.
It was kind of a funny.
I was so blessed by those days where you had people around who could make that level of, you know, that step toward efficiency.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think unfortunately, there was a lot of inefficiencies on that show, not necessarily any fault of ours, because I think that was also one of the shows where we went super hardcore compositing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also interesting.
The beginning's a tweak, too.
The beginning of a tweak, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I guess, I don't know what people call it nowadays, but. I guess, what's a good term for it?
I don't remember.
It's like a compositing lighting.
Right. It's you recomposite back to beauty, right?
Shampositing?
Shampositing is what we called it.
Okay. It was something like that.
So it's shader compositing, where basically you'd
taking output, terms from the shader and then compositing.
Right. You'd basically, we'll disassemble the entire shader and then reassemble it back to beauty and then give all the controls of that shader back to compositing.
Yeah.
But
and then hope that motion blur and anti-aliasing don't mess you up.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was an interesting, and we had a little script, but basically it output all this stuff out of RenderMan and then we'd reassemble it and we'd have a script that's called Pimp My Jet.
Yeah.
And that would basically you'd add all these controls in Nuke that would be able to do that. We actually, on iRobot,
I was going to bring up iRobot because I think that kind of technology came from that.
It started from there, and it was Estrus and Paul George and Jonathan Eggstack.
Yeah, yeah.
They all, I ran into Jonathan at SIGGRAPH last week. I hadn't seen him
in a long
time. I
keep seeing Jonathan at like Bill parties, you know, Bill Spitzak parties.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. He's still over at DreamWorks.
Yeah.
He's doing well there. But anyway, yeah, iRobot was basically like had a thing to reassemble the robot because we weren't ray tracing. We were using RenderMan back then. And so all the glossy refraction mm-hmm. effects were all done in Nuke. And mm-hmm. basically we had a way to find, identify depth of the shell
mm-hmm.
as a shader element.
Yeah.
And then put that out in Nuke. And then also just basically it was a completely transparent shell. And then we would blur it based on distance.
Right.
It was like really hacky, but
it worked.
But it worked.
Yeah.
Yeah. It worked. Wow. This. Yeah.
Now, the funny thing is, like at the time,
right?
I got
nowadays
two or
three... we just do things correctly.
Well, you know, if you recall, at the time, the Mac series of products were putting out that kind of shell, mm-hmm. Like that translucent, but like,
I mean, glossy yeah. refraction.
yeah, glossy refraction.
Right.
So that line of products was kind of giving rise to that motif in CG.
Right.
Right. So I had actually two or three people ask me how to do that.
Right.
Between the end of
without ray tracing.
Without ray tracing. Yeah.
Right.
Just how would it be done and it would look good.
Right.
Right. And so between Tippett and halfway through Stealth.
Right.
And of course, iRobot designs came that way too.
Well, the thing that was interesting about it is it would actually look really good.
Yeah.
But it only knew the distance of the shell. So if a robot was far in the distance, you would have to overall blur it less than if it was closer.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and if a robot is coming from the distance and moving closer to you, then you'd have to animate that variable as yeah. it was moving closer and look.
Well, I mean, really what came down to it, it had to be done in the shader. Like in the end, if you had the ability to ray trace,
right.
It would have been significantly better because really what you need to do is send out a bunch of rays from your one sample point
right.
and measure all of those distances.
Yes.
You know, or whatever.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really, it would always look better if, I mean, depending on the design, it's probably okay to do it the way we ended up doing it. But mm-hmm. If you had something that's almost touching the surface or approaching the surface, you essentially want like more blurry behind and
right.
closer where it's about to touch. It's almost like ambient occlusion.
Right.
And so those are the kind of tricks that you kind of have to discover when you don't have a ray tracer to depend on.
Yeah. I mean, we still use a form of ray tracing with ambient occlusion or reflection occlusion. And it
still looked great.
Yeah. It's still, listen, here's the thing, right? Because when I was at Sony, and that was my last RenderMan show, I was working on Ghost Rider.
Kevin's.
Yeah, yeah, Kevin's great. But I also swore to myself, I was like, I am never going to render a shadow map ever again.
At least just deep shadows. At least that.
Yeah, no. And so I said, no, I'm not going to do this. And I really think that, you know, I was I'm done with this. The thing is, rasterized rendering is not necessarily a non-photoreal thing. It just takes a lot more effort in certain cases to get there.
Getting it more and more cases, but yeah.
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 And you know, nowadays, rasterized rendering is so good that it's, you know, and fast that it's in real time.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
So
now you're getting this quality in video games now.
Video games, yeah. Right. So it just takes a little more effort to get it there on the back end, but it can render super, super fast.
Yeah.
So rasterized rendering is really great at that. It's just that it took longer.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we use the rule of thumb and, you know, back, I remember when I was first starting, it's like each lighter or TD or whoever could pretty much have enough budget to light about 25 to 30 shots on a show because that's how much effort it would take to get a shot. Nowadays, one lighter can light 150 shots on a show,
yeah, you know,
easily,
absolutely.
Because you're not doing as much. You can just get through it faster because you're not having to hack things or do everything else.
Yeah, with PBR, you can do it as long as you know what you're doing with it. It's very easy to break V-Ray,
right?
You know, because there's so many variables to play with,
right?
And it's fun to play with them, but if if someone knows what they're doing, it can very, very quickly get you exactly what you want.
Right.
Especially for most surfaces. Like, granted, there are cases where you want to be able to composite things like in the background that,
sure,
that weren't there when you traced it, you know, that kind of stuff. And then you have to figure that out.
Yeah.
But that's a different scenario than what we were going through then on Stealth. It was,
yeah.
Or on iRobot.
No, I
wasn't actually on iRobot, by the way.
I know. But there were some crossover that happened in terms of the
teams and
the
technology.
And the philosophy of how we were going to do things.
Yeah.
But I think what was also interesting is, I've been saying, it's like, you know, rasterized rendering is not going to replace ray tracing. Ray tracing is going to still stay on. What do you think about that?
I don't think ray tracing, like by itself, like the fundamental ray tracer.
Right.
I don't think that goes away, but I don't think anyone will be using it once we get everyone well versed and working in compositing with like full path tracing.
Path tracing, sure.
Right. And I know I'm drawing a difference there, but there
why
are still...
Why are you drawing a difference, and what's the difference that you see?
I think of a ray tracer as something where you're still controlling everything with a shader, but you can send out rays.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
And that means that the fundamental rendering part isn't very complicated. It's just calling a shader.
Okay.
Right. So it's still acting like RenderMad in
sure.
1990s, right? But you can ray trace. Path tracing... Very different animal because it's participating. It's probably controlling more of how light distributes than the shader. The shader is just kind of giving it cues about probability and probability and different colors appearing.
Uh huh.
But it controls it.
Right.
Right. So when I draw the difference, it's not that the ray tracing part of the code changes.
Yes.
But how you think about how you render is much different.
Right. Yeah. And. Yes, and I think that's going to become.
People still use ray tracers, right? Like,
sure.
Mental Ray its strong suit is still ray tracing,
right?
You know, and then they have a lot of assist functions for helping it look more photoreal,
right?
And it was just more like early 2000s kind of technology,
right? But what's happening with path tracing and GPU path tracing is the way to go,
exactly.
Like, yeah.
There's just no way to make that fake. You have to collect that information, along multiple balances or in the case of participating media, multiple steps.
Yeah. And I think it's going to go live. I mean, I think it's going to go real time.
Oh, I hope so.
Did you see the video today? I think it was, or it came out like last week or where they showed Quick 2 path traced.
Dude, I couldn't even go to SIGGRAPH. I couldn't go to SIGGRAPH.
It wasn't at SIGGRAPH. It was just some video that came.
No, I'm just trying to illustrate how much time I have or don't have in this case.
All right. Well, someone did a Quake 2 that's path traced, which is interesting.
Interesting.
So you're playing Quake 2, but it's instead of doing it, in OpenGL or whatever, it's path tracing.
What's the latency and what's it computing on?
It's a little grainy.
Yeah.
It's a little grainy, especially in the the glossy reflections.
Yeah.
And I think the resolution was not super high, but it definitely was playable. And
I love that.
Yeah.
Because imagine the implication.
Eventually, that's what's going to be, right?
Yeah, eventually, like, if I'm ready to render, I just hit play.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I know. That's been my long-term fantasy with rendering.
Yeah.
Even as early as the early 90s.
Yes.
Because back then, CG, it's going to solve everything. Jurassic Park comes out and everybody thinks there's a one button fix for making a dinosaur. And of course, that's where you're elevated to, wow, I have a new tool. But
right.
Then you find out once you get into the industry and you start working on it, it's not magic.
It's a lot of labor.
Yeah.
That's the thing that frustrates me the most when everyone's like, it's so much better when it's, not CG, because CG just like me. And it's it's like, look, they made a model. Isn't it amazing? It's much better than the CG. It's like, when you make a CG environment, that's almost just as much work. If not more, because you put a lot of detail into modeling cities and everything else.
No, I have a couple thoughts on that. One is that one of my favorite things is when someone bags on the CG and it's not CG.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, that's my favorite thing. Yeah. Like you need to shut up now. And then
or when they talk about how awesome something is because it's all practical and half of it is CG.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's all like perfect set extension that someone spent months on.
Right.
And then the ideal of the simplicity that people place on visual effects and not thinking about anything really in advance and thinking CG will fix everything.
Right.
And I don't want to bag on any certain producer or whatever else, but it often comes up that it's just automatically CG. But people don't think if I just park a 67 Buick back here, mm-hmm. you just want a 67 Buick back here.
Right.
You know, and I can rent one. I can go over there right now and get it.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And anything in between. We still have miniature companies, even in LA, that can build miniatures that make it look real. And if you just need to go have like a big master shot, go build that.
Yeah.
You know, because especially for like a television series where you're going to do the same shot 100 times.
Yeah.
You know, have it as a set. You know?
I remember it was Daredevil, the Ben Affleck, right?
The Ben Affleck Daredevil, yeah.
Right? And
now we're hearkening into my R&H era.
Right. Well, this was a DD. We were doing a bunch of stuff over there. And then they had one shot somehow where he was supposed to be in the shower. And I guess makeup had done some scars on his back,
yeah.
right? Because it's Daredevil. But they weren't showing up enough in the shot. So instead of like... Fixing it in front of camera, that's like, they'll just fix it in CG.
Yeah.
And so they gave the shot to a guy who was working with us at DD, and he spent 2 weeks tracking his back mm-hmm. because of all the water dripping down. He had to manually track mm-hmm. it. To get this scar, the CG scar, to stick.
Yeah.
And it's like, really?
Really? Yeah.
And it's like, you know, every day was like, hey, how are things going on Ben's back, you know?
I understand that there are politics and things like that.
Sure.
And that you might not be able to get the actor again or
yeah, I get it.
Or you lost the prosthetics gone or something like that. You
sure.
know? And it's going to take too long. There are always those circumstances. But for me, it's more like... like what rubs me the wrong way is when people just kind of like, they don't even think about it. They just throw it over the fence to CG.
Yeah.
You know,
and into this magic box that something comes out of.
Yeah. If you're a filmmaker, make film.
Right.
You know, don't just say, this is in the background. I don't care.
Right.
You know, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think it's a shame that people do that. It just bothers me sometimes. And I've had a whole thing about trying to respect CG because I think right now it's getting dogged and it shouldn't be. It's a pain. Yeah. You were at Rhythm, right?
Oh yeah, I was there for a long time.
You were at Rhythm till the end and
past the end.
Past the end.
Yeah, you know, if there was an afterlife, I was in it at R&H.
Oh,
right. So what happened?
So you were on Life of Pi.
I was briefly on Life of Pi. I think I wrote like one shader for Jason Behaver.
Okay.
Who turned into a great friend? And mm-hmm. by the way, I have to mention something.
Yeah.
That now that the name pops up, I was inducted in the Academy last year, which was a huge event for me. Like, you know, because I've admired film my whole life and I thought that was an unachievable goal considering where I was in my career.
Right.
And Derek Spears came in and he said, you want to be in the Academy, right? And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
And he goes, I'm putting your name up. And so if it wasn't for Derek and then, you know, Jason backing us up at the whatever meeting is where they decide people are inducted.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bill Westenhofer, who was also there. And I worked with Bill on A-Team. And then, of course, all the work at Life of Pi. Mm-hmm. And I really admire the guy's work and his eye. But he, like him, Jason, and Derek are all the ones that got me in there. So, you know, hats off to those guys.
Right. Sorry, I just have to mute that.
Mute that thing.
Yes. But yeah, no, that's awesome. I was very excited when you were inducted into the Academy. So it was a good thing.
Jason, I did something for him and that's kind of where my involvement ended. I did mm-hmm. An iridescent shader for fish or something like that.
Okay.
And it was only like a couple of days.
Got it.
And I really, the thing is, for a long time, I kind of resented that show. And I have to be honest, and I don't mean to seem negative about it because I really respect the work and all the above. But I was told that I was going onto it as the digital supervisor.
Mm.
It wasn't a done deal. And then I found out that they needed me on another show. So this is something that comes up a lot with me, especially in my earlier career.
Mm.
when you have the reputation as a problem solver, someone who can step into a situation and figure it out, suss out solutions and work around the problems, you tend not to be on the big A-list movies, because the big A-list movies have the huge staff and they have the whole list of artists.
Yeah, you come in as the cleaner.
Yeah. And you know, I don't want to mention specific shows, but I got onto I got pulled onto a problem show. Mm-hmm. And once that started to work, I got pulled into another problem show.
Right.
And so I claim a couple of credits that I'm uncredited for because I was on so briefly.
Right.
But I did work on, and then I ended up on a show called RIPD. Mm-hmm. And that lasted for a year and a half.
Right.
And it, that show was just crazy. It, you know, we were consistently getting different art direction. It was shot with guys in mocap suits because they didn't have designs. Not because they wanted like a bunch of CG replacements, but because they just didn't know what the characters were supposed to look like when they were shooting.
Jesus.
I mean, not all the characters, but there's certainly at least one character in there where it's just a photoreal guy, you know, running around and he's got extra arms that kind of hang down. And the original plate is a guy in a mocap suit, you know. And that's there's insane. So much underappreciated work in that movie because of the amount that of effort we put into that.
That's
amazing. We did a photoreal Kevin Bacon delivering lines full frame.
Right.
And no one knows about it. you know?
Well, that's a shame. But yeah, I know you get pulled onto different things. I've had certain shows that I got pulled on. I'm not going to necessarily mention, but there was something where I really wanted to do another this specific thing, and I said, No, we need to you here because we need your expertise in this area. And I'm like, ugh.
And I respect and appreciate that.
Sure.
That's, you have to be an adult about it. You know, it's a professional job and you have to do what you're asked to do.
Yep.
But at one point, I'm just
Or you
like,
could do what other people do and just has a hissy fit.
Well, no, maybe I should start doing that. I don't know. But the thing is, if I had put my foot down and said, no, I'm doing this, then I would get the kudos and I would get, you know, the Cinefex article and all that kind of mess, maybe even Academy Award. I don't know.
Yeah.
But in the end, would I have had the experiences that I grew with?
Right.
Probably not.
Right.
You know, sometimes the name isn't worth it.
No, I don't think so. So anyway, you're now at Pixo. How long have you been at Pixo?
Oh, I love Pixo. I'm enjoying Pixo. It's sometimes we bring in a little bit too much work and we're a little bit understaffed, but that's the only negative thing I had to say about the place.
Right.
Everyone's friendly. They respect what I have to say and, you know, largely kind of execute what I have to say. And then, surprise, they're final.
Right.
And so I really like working there because it's really constructive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost exclusively constructive until it comes down to resource management, which is a bane of every small company right now.
Sure, but you guys are asked to do more and more gigantic things, and you guys have so many resources.
It's blossoming. It's really crazy for us.
You guys still doing a lot of ride stuff, right? Some big ride films and stuff like that?
Yeah, you know, last year I shot a practical fly film. It's a term that, you know, it related to things like... I guess it related to something like California Adventure
or Soarin',
Ride.
Yeah.
So a lot of Chinese like staged location-based entertainment, mm-hmm. Screen type rides are coming out of that because they loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was on one of those rides where they wanted to try to shoot everything practically instead of do it CG.
Okay.
And so I had a great time last year because we went to China a couple times. I think we spent cumulatively probably about 10 weeks shooting and two different trips, one in winter, one in autumn.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife went on the first trip. But we had spent 7 weeks there continuously and we shot tons of different locations. And at one point, I think we were actually in Russia because it was a sequence where we couldn't fly the helicopter because it was on the Russian border.
Huh.
And so instead of being able to go up and help direct the shots and shoot there, I had to negotiate how to shoot reference so we could do it in CG.
Right.
And it's a funny story. I had this a short argument with the line producer who was, you know, the local Chinese representative. Mm-hmm. And she kept saying no to every one of my ideas. Like my first idea, of course, a drone, right?
Right.
Get a drone. We can survey the area. We'll make a model out of it and render it. And we did have the drone on site, and I finally negotiated being able to fly it further away from where we needed it, but right. enough to get sort of a master view of the area. Then my next idea was fly a kite. We'll put a GoPro on a kite because the Russians won't see it and they won't shoot it down. And she said, no, they'll spot it and they'll shoot it down. Okay. Next idea. I'll put a camera on a rig that I'll build to aim it and shoot it up with a slingshot. And this is a real idea. Like I was trying to figure anything
just
out.
Just throw it up in the air.
Yeah. It was essentially one of those cameras you throw up in the air and try to, except throw it way up in the air.
Right.
You know, and she fought me on that. Like, you'll never get the camera back. We're not wasting equipment on this. And I was like, I'll buy it. But I couldn't even do that. So I ended up, I have pictures of myself with this 3-meter pole.
Yeah.
Which is essentially a monopod for a mic.
Yeah.
That we put a camera mount on. And so we went around with a Lumix and a 5D shooting reference as high as we could get it.
Yeah.
And that's how we set the sequence up. At one point, though, like I said, we were on a boat. Because the area, there's a river that sort of crosses the Russian border.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to get out on that river because there's a special church that everyone is claiming is theirs. That's the political contention. Mm-hmm. And we had to get reference to this church, and it was on technically Russian soil, so I couldn't go there. And so I looked over and I said, is that charterable? And so Madison, our translator / coordinator, mm-hmm. went and talked to the captain and said, yeah, no problem. It's going to cost this much. It ended up being like $30 US.
Right.
And so this guy takes us out in the river, and I'm like, a little more to the right, no, get us closer. Just keep going closer. And I look back and there's a Russian trawler back there
right.
with 50-millimeter guns on the deck. And, they're kind of looking at us, but not really approaching right. us. I'm like, get closer. We were in Russia.
Right.
And gotcha. So, because I looked down at one point when I was shooting, and I couldn't have been from here to that wall, under 10, 15 feet
right.
from the coastline. And so I got all the reference I needed.
Right.
And it was a good experience in the end, but interesting negotiating, like trying to get reference, just even reference.
Right.
And then, funny enough, after we got everything that we needed, mm-hmm. we walked the entire area on foot and shot with this stupid pole. And
there was Graham Fife and I came up with this idea, which actually we saw somehow someone actually made a product like this. Well, it wasn't just Graham and I, but and that was Daniel. The idea was to create a 360 camera of some kind,
mm-hmm.
right? But put it in a ball.
Yeah,
and then just you put an accelerometer.
That's a product.
It is a product now. There's an accelerometers in it, and
yeah.
then you throw it up in the air, and when it reaches its zero point, it takes a picture.
Yeah, it takes a picture. Yeah. And I wish that had been.
We had actually thought of that a long time ago, and it's like, shit, someone actually made it.
Yeah, yeah. And if it had been full on HDR, it would have been awesome.
Yeah.
But the backstory, like the post story, this really irked me the wrong way. It took a little bit of a negotiation to get just even the drone up where we got it up,
sure.
which was a couple miles away.
Right.
And I sent the coordinator Madison out with the drone operator to talk to these Chinese guards to see if it was cool if we flew it. Come on, guys, look how cool this drone is. Mm-hmm. Let us fly it. And she said, you can't come because you look Russian. So, and I said, okay, that totally makes sense. Just go talk to them. And they were very reticent because the Chinese military could go either way.
Right.
And I said, feel out the situation. If you see any problem, just say, I'm sorry for bothering you and come back.
Okay.
But they were gone and they were able to fly it.
Right.
So meantime, Sean Phillips and me, the director, were walking around with this stupid camera pole thing, taking reference right. of the roads and the banks and the part, the edges of the river and the foliage and all that. And my wife was there also, taking signs and just whatever we could get
mm-hmm.
because we knew we needed maybe all of it. We didn't know.
Right.
Camera path had not been established. And so we make it back to the visitor center
mm-hmm.
Where they have this huge Chinese monument, like 30-meter tall Chinese monument that is the first place in China that the sun touches every morning.
Okay.
So it's called Sun Plaza. So we go into this visitor center and she, I have her ask and it turns out that people fly drones there all the time. like all the time. Like they're like, there's a drone here probably every day.
Right.
I'm like, oh, son of a,
right.
You know, and I wasn't allowed to fly it.
Interesting.
Yeah. But, you know, all in all, we still got to see these beautiful terrains. You know, you hear stories about Beijing and other places in China where there's smokestacks everywhere. And certainly I've seen that. But when you get into these smaller towns, it's like being in Hawaii.
Right.
It's gorgeous. The food's pure. People right. are nice. Everyone's considerate.
Yeah.
China has sort of a bad rap that way. It's like people judge by, you know, walking into Beijing and seeing all the cloud of smoke overhanging right. everything and how rude everyone is. But that's just the culture. That's the big business culture.
Right.
And you get into the smaller towns and it's like I said, it's like being in Hawaii.
Amazing. So this particular, is this now a ride? People can go see it in China if they're in China?
Yeah. If you're in China and you happen to be in Heilongjiang province, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, in Harbin,
okay,
there's a place called the Wanda Mall there mm-hmm. that has two of these screens and they're projecting our stuff now.
That's awesome.
And it was just wrapped a couple of weeks back.
Oh wow!
Yeah, okay. So it just started.
Okay, great.
So it was a really soft wrap because we were still doing digital work after our schedule was over.
Okay,
but I think the last shot went out, I think, 2 weeks ago.
Okay,
maybe three.
All right. Well, that's great. So I think we're just over an hour, so it's perfect.
Well, let's keep going. I love this.
What else do you want to talk about, Johnny?
Just to finish up on Pixo, I've started to work on another Chinese project
uh-huh.
that's actually going to finish really soon. It's like Chinese Top Gun.
Okay.
It's a really short schedule, but we're trying to put shots out with very high quality.
Yes.
And one thing, and I wanted to bring this up about Pixo, is like, you trust everyone there. You know,
sure.
It's like being like in a company of excellent artists.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you've got a bunch of staff that just don't know what they're doing. And then you've got a couple of guys you trust. It's, you can depend on, if somebody's in a department, you know, they're doing the job.
Right.
You know, and that's what I really like about Pixo is like professionally, if you can get the resources on your work, you're yep. going to get excellent work out of it.
Excellent.
And then on top of that, we have multiple offices like all over the globe. There's like seven offices.
Yeah, a lot. What's the line is like, there's always one office working on something.
Yes.
Because you're scattered yes. across the entire yes. globe.
We even have a Beijing office.
You have a Beijing office.
It's the weirdest yeah. thing. I never visited the Beijing offices. I was in Beijing a couple times.
Interesting.
Weird,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So yeah, that's been the philosophy of Pixo. And I've known those guys for a long time, long time.
Yeah. You know Miguel, right?
Miguel?
De Los Rios?
No,
you haven't.
When Pixo first moved to LA, I was good friends with Rainer Gumbusch. So Rainer was one of the guys who opened the LA office.
Oh, interesting.
I believe. I may be getting my facts wrong, so please correct me if I'm wrong. But I think that Rainer was one of the first sort of opened there. And he had been working in Germany on the Red Baron stuff before.
Cool.
And
cool.
So then he decided.
That's really solid work for what they had to work with.
Oh, like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's
yeah.
one of the reasons why I decided to go to the company.
Yeah. So Rainer was part of that. And then I think he was doing the Game of Thrones stuff when Pixo was doing most of Game of Thrones in like season one and two.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Still is. In fact, I just watched, you know, the last Game of Thrones. We were just talking about it before we recorded, where I saw his name in the credit as additional visual effects supervisor of
yeah.
Rainer Gumbusch. So he's been involved in the Game of Thrones stuff for a long time.
Yeah.
And just another side note, Rainer and I sat next to each other on Day After Tomorrow. And he was modeling at that time.
Was that was wrapping when I got back from Tippett too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he modeled the freight ship. Like, he modeled a lot of things, but one of the things he spent a lot of time, the freight ship that floats down Fifth Avenue. So, yeah.
I think I touched that show too at some point.
You may have.
I don't remember.
I don't remember.
That's a long time ago.
Oh, yeah. The fiasco's on that one. But yeah, so Rainer and I knew each other from
oh, Karen saying the water's too green, it's too blue, it's too green.
Karen.
Like, even I heard about that.
Yeah, that's a whole bag of noodles there. But yeah, it was for a first movie in visual effects, like, wow. You know, for my first job in visual effects, and I was like, working in movies is drama.
Was that your first one?
Yeah, Day After Tomorrow was my first one. I mean, I'd done CG for a long time as an architect.
Yeah, because I remember meeting you. I don't remember the exact circumstances of meeting you, but my first impression of you is that you really knew what you were doing about CG.
Yeah, well, I'd done it in architecture. Okay, and I'd done it for, you know, my first thing at CG was actually 1990 or something when I first started dabbling in Mathematica and realizing that I could start to see, because I was a math major in undergraduate.
So hats off to you.
Thanks, man. I love math. And then I got into it when I, you know, moved to Rice and architecture and all that stuff. So I really just knew a lot about that stuff. And when people were telling me, it was like, Johnny's coming. It was literally like, everyone was so excited.
That's so cool to hear. I kind of got that vibe.
I was very excited to meet you and talk to you. Cause I was like, I can't wait to, I have a lot of questions.
Oh, cool.
So it was really,
did you ever ask them?
I did. Oh. I did. And you and I got along really well. I'm always excited to see you. And I was the same thing when I found out you were on Academy, I was like, congratulations.
Oh, thanks, man.
So it's always cool. Yeah. You're very, very knowledgeable. You're one of those people, like, you know, that I can reach out and talk to about stuff. Like, just
like the definition of good and evil.
Yeah. Well, Doug Robel's another one, right?
Yeah.
Doug,
yeah. Absolutely.
I had a random question that I don't work at Digital Domain anymore and nothing else, but I said, you know what? I know one person who can help me with this question, and that's going to be Doug. And I sent him an email, and he was like, yeah. And he says, here's your best resources for this. And by the way, I happen to have done a chalk talk on the subject.
Yeah, here you go.
And here you go. And he gave me that. I was like, oh, my God, it's awesome.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you've always been a great resource and someone to admire and trust your opinion about stuff a lot.
Well, I think you could say that about Doug from me.
Right.
You know.
Exactly.
I loved just sitting in a room with Doug when we had time to talk.
That's what was so cool about that first time. And I don't think it was 97. It was probably 99, if I'm thinking about it, whenever Grinch came out. So it was right after Grinch. But just hearing that talk of you and Doug talking about your different philosophies of how to tackle things.
You know?
And him thinking long-term development and you thinking short-term development, it was really fascinating. So.
Well, I don't have the attention span to do long-term development, so.
Yep. All right. Well, listen, we got to wrap it up because I've got, unfortunately, a couple other things to do, but this has been awesome. Thank you so much, Chris. Johnny, for being on, and we finally got to do it.
Yay! No motorcycle accident. Cool. No illness.
Stay safe on your way back to work.
Thanks, man.
All right. Thank you.